From the Marquee Media Studio inside Mark Tank, it's the Mark Haney Show.
Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show, and we are on a mission to ignite the entrepreneurial revolution right here in the hometown we love. And we do that by building the Backyard Advantage, the most connected community in the world for local entrepreneurs. And I like to share stories of winning businesses, people in our region that are succeeding. And really, they're part of the fabric of the entrepreneurial ecosystem here in the Sacramento region, which is strengthening much to the leadership of some of these business people. And so today on the show, I have Maggie Bender Johnson, President and CEO of Bender Insurance Solutions. You may have heard of them. I know I see their signage as I drive down Highway 65. And you guys do a lot for our community. You're obviously a significant insurance provider for a lot of people. So I look forward to getting to know you, understanding some of your principles around winning and leadership. But let's just get to know you and your background. Maggie, welcome to the show.
Awesome. Thank you, Mark. And thank you so much for having me. I've been looking forward to this. So this is my 20th year with my family's business. I am third generation. The business was founded by my grandpa 87 years ago.
Oh my gosh.
My dad joined him in the 70s, and my dad was really the one that grew our business.
Okay, but in terms of starting an insurance company 87 years ago, let's see, what year would that have been?
1938.
So at the end of the Depression, I guess, right? In the 30s was the Depression. So he decided to start an insurance company at that time. I guess we were kind of coming out of the Depression then. Do you hear stories about like when it originated, like from your dad your grandpa?
Yeah.
Okay, how did it start? What happened?
So my grandpa comes from an ag family.
Okay.
I grew up in the Chico area, and his father, who was a farmer, said, son, there's got to be an easier way to earn money. So focus on the business side of things. And so my grandpa was an accountant at a auto dealership, and someone contacted him and said, would you like to start an independent insurance agency? And he thought, yeah, I could do that. And so he moved his family down to Sacramento in the late 30s. And it was just him for many years. He went off to World War II. Somehow his agency still operated. I'm sure he had a part-time helper or something. But he kept it pretty small until the 70s when my dad joined.
Okay.
So that's over 30 years.
And it was prompted by the auto industry, which autos were just taking off, I'd say, in the 30s, right? I mean, obviously, we had automobiles since maybe the turn of the century, but the business really started taking off, and I guess people were crashing into each other. Is that what it was?
I like that.
Is that what was happening? Is like you need to solve the problem of automotive crashes and stuff?
No, I think it was that, hey, you can be basically a franchise owner of this AAA agency, like 3A,
okay.
That's out today.
Yeah.
And he thought, yeah, I'd like to try something on my own.
Okay, so then your dad takes over in the 70s and the business takes off. And your dad's Steve Bender.
Yes.
Yeah, and I know him somewhat to say that I know him well would be an overstatement, but tons of respect for you and your family and what you've built. Maybe talk to us a little bit about what happened after your dad took over.
Yes. So he started running the business in the 70s. And then in the 80s, my grandpa, who had seen a market that's very similar to this, he said, I'm done. This is for a younger man. And so my dad happily stepped in to be president. My grandpa retired, and then my dad started hiring folks to grow the business.
Okay, so get a little history here on this. Is a market similar to this? Are you talking about an economy similar to this or an insurance market?
Insurance market.
Oh, why is it similar to, I guess, the early 80s?
What my grandpa was experiencing is that he wasn't able to do business the old school way like he used to. Mm-hmm. He was all about really taking someone by their word and a handshake, and he started having some of the underwriters that worked for the companies not standing by their word. And so he was done with that.
Okay.
The market was the market right now is terrible in California for insurance.
Because of the litigiousness of society?
No, it's a lot of factors. I'd say that the government has a big role in this, that in trying to control the increasing rates for consumers. Mm. They put a cap on that, and that stifled the market. And now we're in at a place where so few personal insurance carriers even are writing business. And now we've had a massive fire down in, or several fires in LA, which are really going to test.
Yes, I would imagine the underwriters are fleeing California like crazy in because of the fires for the, you know, property insurance and that kind of thing. What about business insurance? Maybe describe a little bit about your business too as I jump around here a little bit. Your business, I didn't realize you guys did like personal insurance as well. You do a variety. Can you give us an overview of the company?
Sure. Yeah. So we have about 55 employees. Okay. We're about $12 million in revenue. That is our commission from the insurance companies. We place over $100 million in premium for our clients, but we consider our commission our revenue. We're about 70% commercial lines, 12% employee benefits, which is a commercial product. Mm-hmm. Same percentage for surety, which is also a commercial product. And then the rest is personal lines, which we're not actively targeting growth. Yeah. It's more of an accommodation because we want to be the holistic broker for our clients.
Right. Okay. So sounds like it's an important percentage is the consumer side or the personal side, but it's not... it's not a major part. What now you say things are like what they were in the 80s at some level. What happened in the 80s that made businesses harder to insure?
Well, I think at that point interest rates were crazy, and mm-hmm. so it was just a little harder to do business. I mean, they're not completely similar. It was just a challenging time mm-hmm. in business, and my grandpa saw that as a good way to get out, like a lot of people did with COVID.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, I guess it's a good news that your grandpa decided to do that because the company's taken off from there. So it was a smaller company then.
Yes.
And then talk to us about that growth then. What happened?
So my dad continue to grow the business by adding new clients as well as employees to add new clients. And as he grew it allowed him to have family members join as well. So his brother joined in the 80s, my older male cousin joined in the 90s, and then my two sisters and I all joined in the early 2000s.
And you are the CEO of the company. How did that happen? How did you become the CEO? You've got obviously other family members that were running around that probably love the business, but you must have been the most qualified, I assume.
Yes. And I was the only one that really wanted it.
Oh, okay.
My cousin Chris showed some interest, but he didn't do the same work as I did to go to business school and take advanced coursework. So he actually left the business a couple years ago to pursue his vision of being a Christian pastor. Pastor,
mm-hmm.
And moved out to Illinois and is running a parish out there. So really happy for him.
That's great. That's a great story. And you became an employee-owned company at some point. You created an ESOP, an employee stock ownership plan, which is an interesting thing because there's other people that have business partners that are family members and they're kind of like they're employee owned, but you formalized it. And tell us about that process.
Absolutely. So pretty much since I joined the company, I was very focused on how do I give my dad some liquidity so that he can retire and really benefit from all the hard work he's done. And we went through a couple of iterations of a succession plan. One that actually got somewhere was there were 8 of us that were buying shares actively, but our growth, we doubled in a 5-year time frame, and we just didn't have much, you know, you pull them out and the moths come out. So,
the company was worth a lot, and so how do you finance that but still retain the ownership at some level?
Yes. And my dad, had I wanted to be the only owner, he would have backed the note. You know, mm-hmm. but I didn't want that because I love this dynamic that we were building of like shared leadership and that we had this up and coming next gen team that was really driving the business. And so we had some misgivings about ESOPs before we went into it that, oh, we'd lose total control. The employees would be, you know, it'd just be madness. Everybody would know what everyone else makes and they could say what they want to make. And so we decided, hey, we were very committed to not selling externally. So let's really check out this ESOP concept. And so I went to a couple of conferences and interviewed a lot of ESOP folks just to find out what's working well and what didn't work. And so after doing all of that, just the process of becoming an ESOP and 100% ESOP, there's definitely advantages. As a S Corp, we don't pay federal income tax. That really helps us, pay off the debt service. Yes.
Yeah, there's tax benefits like crazy. And is it true? Did you find that you have a market value if you were to go out and sell to a, let's call it a competitor or private equity or something like that? Did you find that you were able to get the same level of valuation, or you basically made up for it in taxes?
No, I'd say that we sold for about a third of what we could have gotten for strategic value on the outside market. So it took all of us looking at each other and saying, what are our priorities? And are we okay with this? And we were. Mm-hmm. And so...
You actually sold some of your shares because you already owned some shares at that time. Okay, got it. What about the new owners? What was their reaction? How did you tell them? What happened?
They knew that we were exploring this option because we were fairly transparent with them, and we had been trying to interest them in buying more shares. And so they know that if no one's buying them, we have to come up with another option. But folks were happy to get the payout for the ESOP transaction.
Yeah, the eight of you that own some shares. But what about the new owners? They must have been ecstatic about, like, I now own part of the company? Oh my gosh.
It took a lot of explaining, and it still does. It's been 7 or 8 years. Folks, ESOPs are not very common. I think there's maybe 7,000 in the U.S. Don't quote me on that.
Okay.
But it's the questions we were getting were all over the place. Like, can I see us on the NASDAQ now? You know?
Okay.
And so I think that the most valuable knowledge we were able to impart on them was how to think like owners.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause that's really been a game changer for us. And in this employee market, it's been a great way to recruit and retain people, to know that, hey, you have this awesome retirement asset that is growing significantly, 'cause we're seeing double digit growth every year, and you don't have to put a penny into it. And we're not reducing any benefits or comp for you to have this.
Yeah, no, I would think that they would be super pumped up. I know of other ESOPs that have been created, and it drove more loyalty, and it drove company growth, that kind of thing, because employees are more engaged. Have you seen that kind of response among your team?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. We already have. I think the reason we were such a good fit for an ESOP is that we were already on our way towards our culture was shifting in that direction already, so it wasn't hard. Constantly I'm hearing people say, is this the best use of ESOP dollars?
So I'm kind of thinking that, so one thing that's interesting to me is I'm a member of the Capital Region Family Business Center, and I don't really have a family business. I own a number of businesses, and we invest, and my kids are in and around, but they have their own stuff that they do. So we're really not a family business, but somehow I joined because I thought it was a cool thing, and I haven't quit yet. So, and it is cool. A lot of great people in the family business center. But you're the president. Are you the CEO too, or what?
I'm the
chairman
of the board.
President of the board. Okay.
And then we have a staff that work for us too.
And I can see that you were a family business, but now you're a hybrid of a family business. Maybe a little bit like what I've got at some level. You still feel at home? Why stick around? Why still lead that?
I feel like I have so much more purpose because I'm not just working for the 8 shareholders. I'm working for the 55 shareholders and their families. So for me, as CEO, my purpose just ramped up big time. And to the Family Business Center, That was actually in my mind as we were looking to go ESOP, because I love the Family Business Center. We were one of the founding businesses. Two of my best friends I met through their leadership program. And so I didn't want to give that up, but obviously that's not the top priority. And so we approached them and said, hey, our intent is to continue to be family led. And if there's a fourth generation family member that is capable and interested, we would, you know, invite them in, but we're not owned by the family. I mean, I am an ESOP participant. Mm-hmm. But, and so they were okay with it because
you're Maggie Bender. We're keeping you.
I do a lot of work on the board. Maybe that influenced
it. I love it. Now you met some of your friends there, and maybe just describe the Capital Region Family Business Center. What is it and why do you donate your time to it?
Yeah, the Capital Region Family Business Center exists to help family businesses to grow and perpetuate. And a family business is just like a regular business, but I think with a little more baggage. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful. It's just so much more high stakes when you have all your eggs in one basket. Mm-hmm. And I experienced that when I was coming up in leadership. I had conflict with my sister who reported to me, and then my dad who was transitioning out. And so it's when you have a tight-knit family, and you always go to each other when you're having challenges, but now you're having challenges with the family. Mm. It's hard.
So yeah, that's what you're saying by all your eggs in one basket. If something doesn't go good at work, it can easily disrupt the home. I can imagine that. How do you resolve that kind of stuff? Or how do people who do it successfully resolve it?
Yeah. So the Family Business Center has affinity groups where I've been able to connect with a lot of peers. So like Kevin Fatt, Ryan Beatty, they're in very similar situations to me with their businesses. And so if I've got a problem with a sibling, I'll often text or call them.
Fatt, that's the restaurant group.
And then Ryan Beatty's with Holt of California, the large Caterpillar dealer.
Oh, yeah. I know Ken Monroe's been on the show before. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So yeah, they have... they're human just like the rest of us. They don't always see eye to eye, and then you have to figure out a way to work through that. So, okay, so you have peer mentorship sort of.
Absolutely. Yeah. Also, I've got an executive coach who's fabulous and a therapist. So when my sister and I or my dad and I were really clashing, we brought in the therapist just to help us find a common language to work mm-hmm. through stuff.
One of the things that we are doing, we all live on the same family compound, and we're writing a family mission statement. And so do you have one of those?
No, I think that's
yeah.
like a personal
We haven't
one,
written but... it yet. So the kids, my kids are 36 and 38, so they're writing it, and they're supposed to be presenting it to my wife and I so that it can be a shared mission. Even though technically we're not a family business, we still operate. My kids both have offices out of this building, and so in many ways, it's easy to not see eye to eye, especially when you're living on the same property.
Oh yeah,
yeah. So anyway, so that's one of the things that I've thought was important, is just communicating what we're all about, and a lot of times we do that in a mission statement. So okay, so thinking about that, so you have had this, I guess, career trajectory where you've had to demonstrate leadership, and you mentioned that you had been gone through leadership classes and that kind of thing. I feel like everything is a leadership issue. If you want to build a great family, if you want to build a great company, if you want to build a great community, if you want to build a great country, it's all about the leadership, or at least it begins totally. With the leadership. So talk to me about your leadership style, and then what makes a great leader, and what have you learned?
I would say my leadership style has definitely evolved as I've matured and been more open to feedback. So it was very, I didn't care so much about getting real buy-in originally. I would come forward with an idea, push it through, and not really care about the question.
And real buy-in. What does not real buy-in look like when it's not like they've accepted it reluctantly?
Pretty much. There's some head nodding, but maybe there's like, I don't know where this is going to go. And mm-hmm. so I've learned that ideas get implemented so much better when you not only have the buy-in, but then you're able to massage it with the feedback from folks. It's going to be a better solution. So I've definitely been opening myself up to different ideas. Like just this morning, someone was trying to do something different with their email signature. And I was talking to the brand manager and I was like, well, just say no. But then I was thinking, oh, well, maybe we should have our pictures in there. I'm just really trying to think differently because, you know, the most expensive words in business are we've always done it this way, you know?
Yes, I can definitely agree with that. So thinking about that, so what makes a great leader in your mind? Are there people that you respect as leaders that you either try to emulate or you look up to in terms of leadership?
Yes, I'd say that I was very fortunate to be able to work with my dad for 18 years. He and I are very different in our personality and leadership styles. And when I moved into operations and then leadership maybe, what was it, like 15 years ago, I was very aware of what I wasn't. That my dad is this charismatic leader that people would always say how much they love him. And I'm very different from that. I'm not as warm. And so I was really trying to become him, but not recognizing all the strengths that I had in myself and how being different was actually what the business needed at this point in our evolution. So, I continue to, we also have a fabulous board of directors that I look to. Being an ESOP, it caused us to have to really go serious on a board. So we have 4 outside members, you know, it's an 8-person board and they're very impressive individuals and they've been eager to help me.
Yeah. So they add value. They're not. Micro, you know, it's not strictly like oversight. It's more to help.
Definitely.
Yeah. Very cool. So your dad is a charismatic leader. When did you recognize that you maybe don't have to be that way? Was there an event that happened that prompted you to go, look, I can be myself?
No, no, I'd say I've had a couple of executive coaches and the first one was very similar to me in the DISC personality. I'm a CD personality. I'm pretty direct, a little withdrawn. And she's like, that's great. Look it, I had this successful career. And then I got a different executive coach and she helped me to see, you know, but do a 360 and say, these are your superpowers right here, but these are growth opportunities and you can't ignore any of them. So I also ChatGPT is awesome, you know, sometimes because I use it a lot and I've put in my 360 profile and other assessments and I'll say, what do you think of me? What are my growth areas? Mm-hmm. And
Have you ever like put a situation into ChatGPT? Hey, my coworker is doing this or somebody in my family is doing that. And based upon you knowing me, what's the best way to handle it?
Yes, definitely. And often they'll talk me off the ledge of sending a heated email or making, you know, unfair demands, just kind of a balanced, calm perspective.
That's awesome. Okay, let's get to know you personally. So I understand you have 4 dogs.
I do.
Is that right?
I do.
How did you end up with 4 dogs? What happened? You're married, no kids.
No kids.
4 dogs.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, we love dogs and then lived in Midtown for a couple of years. My husband's a Sac City firefighter and just living in Midtown, it's fun, but also the homeless just got to be too much, especially since as a firefighter, those are his calls. He's going on 911 calls for, you know, homeless overdoses. And so we thought, you know what, this is a great opportunity to move out to the country. So we moved up towards Grass Valley, got 6 acres and then thought, why not pile on some more dogs?
That's great. So what kind of dogs do you have?
We have 2 Labradoodles, a Tibetan Terrier, and then a Golden Doodle.
Do they all sleep with you?
Unfortunately. Well, I'm not sleeping. They're sleeping.
Yeah.
Because one's only like 10 months old, and so he's... Yeah.
So they do sleep with you guys in your room? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
My daughter has 4 dogs as well, and they sleep in her room too. I don't know if they all get up on the bed or what, but it's like... How do you do that?
I don't sleep well.
Oh, gosh.
Between that and the snoring.
Yeah. It's is that rough. Your husband?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, as a Sac City firefighter, I need to support him to get as much sleep as he can because they're getting woken up all the time for calls.
And, oh, my gosh.
But when he retires in 2 years, the snoring will not be accepted.
Yeah. I love it. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about insurance, though, because I think a lot of our listeners, they have businesses and... I'll speak for myself. I'm not motivated when I talk to my insurance carrier. It doesn't like put me in a good mood. It's almost like puts me in a bad mood. Like, you guys tend to make us worry about stuff that we weren't even thinking about. Like, what are the biggest things we should be worrying about that we probably don't?
The biggest things. Okay, so as an employer in California, that's getting sued by one of your employees.
Yeah.
So I'd say that's something that we should definitely pay attention to.
Yeah. So what kind of lawsuits are you seeing right now most? And is there an insurance product that covers it?
Yeah. So we're seeing the increase of lawsuits are around discrimination, wrongful termination, those types of employee claims. And then that's employment practices liability. And then cyber risk. We see that increasing too. And so you can get a cyber policy, which will protect both you as well as if you incur liability because now you've breached 1,000 people's, you know, records. I mean, I'd say those are the hot ones right now. Fire insurance is a hot commodity, because of kind of what I was talking about earlier, how the market has just been impacted so negatively. So I'll give you my personal insurance story. So we moved up 10 years ago to Auburn. Homeowners insurance was probably like $2,500 and home was valued at like $1.1 million. 10 years later, I'm spending $20,000 on homeowners insurance with the peril of fire just being $17,000 in premium alone with a $10,000 deductible. So the market has shifted so much that there are no carriers that want to insure me. I have to go to the FAIR plan and I'm going to pay close to 10 times what I was.
So what will it be? Oh, you'll pay. Oh, it's basically close to $20,000 a year or so. Yeah. But what about the concern of maybe not being able to get insurance? Are you seeing that out there where there are just certain areas of California that just you can't get insurance?
I think that's what the FAIR plan is for. Okay. Just the concern right now with the FAIR plan is that we saw with the LA fires that they didn't have anywhere near enough in reserves to pay their claims. And so they exhausted their reserves of like $500 million and then they used their reinsurance and now they have another I'm making these numbers up, but many billions more to pay out, which they're going to assess the insurance companies for. So not only will the insurance companies have to pay for the buildings that they insured that burned down, but now they have to cover the bill of the FAIR plan. So that's going to affect their ability to pay future claims and how they're going to price good risks up in Northern California.
What about the solvency of an underwriter? If you have to, I mean, what happened in Southern California was enormous. And, you know, talk about the value of those homes and rebuilding those things, that's going to cost a lot of money.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, are there going to be insurance providers that just don't make it because of that?
Possibly. I was talking to a large insurance provider down in LA last week, and he told me our losses were about $1.1 billion. So that's how much we're going to have to pay for the homes we insured. And then we were assessed also by the FAIR plan. I asked how much. And he said, we can't share that because they're a publicly traded company. Mm-hmm. And that information, I'm going to sell all my shares, you know, right away. But it's...
Are you seeing lawsuits filed against, let's say, state of California, people like that for not putting out the fire, allowing it to happen, not having any water in the fire hydrants?
I think LA County just sued Edison Electric. I mean, the lawsuits are going to be huge.
Yeah.
I don't know if someone would sue the California Department of Insurance. I wouldn't think that they'd be totally off base by doing that, but because they did create this mess. But
okay. So thinking about the Sacramento region and what's happening here, you're dealing with businesses all over the Sac region. Talk to me about, I guess, where you see it. It's evolved over the last 20 years. You've been working in this realm for 20 years, maybe more, but you seem too young to be working in this business for 20 years. But if you have, what have you seen change in terms of sentiment, the togetherness? You know, I'm trying to build this backyard advantage and connectivity among entrepreneurs. How have you seen the small business and entrepreneurial scene change over the years?
I'd say just with your efforts alone has been a huge change. It's so cool. And I drive by your building every day, so I get to see your huge sign. I'd say that COVID has kind of changed how people run their businesses, and like the way that we thought, hey, we need these things in order to be a real business, like a storefront or an office. And now they're going more virtual. Mm-hmm. We just had a meeting this morning with our real estate broker to help us map out what space do we think we'll need, you know, when our lease comes up for renewal. And it's
you're using less office space these days too.
Oh yeah, we sublet two parts of our office during COVID, and
you're in an area with really nice offices, and obviously you've got much bigger signage than what we do on ours. But we have co-working space here, so we have 17,000 square feet of space, and we have, when COVID happened for us, it was like a ghost town. But now we're 100% occupied. And so I think people have found that maybe these co-working spaces like ours or these suites, you can sort of have you can reduce your expense. You can have a small office. You don't need the big office. And so people are, you know, smaller businesses are moving to this kind of model.
I totally agree, especially a more creative type of where you really need to collaborate to refine your business. I think that totally makes sense. And we don't have it all figured out. We're right now, we haven't required folks to come back in. If you can work remote effectively, we're okay with that. Mm-hmm. And it's also allowed us to hire a bunch of people in other states. We're in like 10 other states right now. So,
so you were already used to working remotely with your, with the reach and in your geography.
Yes. And for our staff right now, it works, but when we get to a point where we want to really lean into training and developing folks new to insurance, we're going to have to figure out how to do in person because Zoom training is not the same.
Yeah, it's hard to motivate by modem. And that's like one of that. I think, especially companies that are growing and you've got new people coming in, they need to get involved in the culture, right? They have to hear it from the originators face-to-face, I think, is much better than the strictly remote. So thinking about that is, do you think that it's going to change and go back to where we all work closer together?
In talking to my friends that do have kids, they say that their generation will be more interested in being in the office.
Okay.
And so I do think there will be a swing. I don't think it'll be a full swing back. And I think it depends. Some of the decisions to say everybody back in the office 5 days, I don't care. That wouldn't work well in our culture.
Yeah.
If there was a good reason why, they would absolutely do it.
One of my companies is the largest security. I don't talk about it that much on the show, but we're the largest security camera company that sells into the casino area. And so we all worked in an office, and then COVID prompted this remote work. And so their sales force is all over the place. They have a small office where they can go to and collaborate and have team meetings, but our employees are all over the country as well. So it's made us more efficient. That's what I've seen is, wow, we're way more efficient, rent's cheaper, and there's a lot of good in it. But we had this, you know, we've had this business since 2004. And so, is that right? Yeah, 2004. So we've had it a long time. So the employees, they all know each other really well.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's been effective for them to go remote. And how about AI? You mentioned using ChatGPT. How is AI affecting the insurance industry?
I'd say slowly. Some of our competitors have had bots or programs built to do minor tasks that I would love to free up our folks to focus on higher level items. But we're at this point, I wouldn't say taking baby steps, smaller steps towards showing our employees what ChatGPT or similar products can do for their communication.
Mm-hmm.
Because we seem to employ a lot of introverts. And so there's reluctance to sometimes do an add a girl for, you know, a coworker, because you feel like your coworkers are going to think you write poorly. And so, well, guess what? Write something and then ChatGPT will fix it for you.
We're seeing a lot of automated workflows. So in order, in other words, the employees are becoming much more efficient because the robots, the software is doing it for them. So they're able to do, I'd say, more valuable tasks like communicate with the customers directly and build relationships and that kind of thing. So we're beginning to see that in different areas. I don't think we have anything that's involved specifically for an insurance agency, but definitely stuff in banking and other areas that's really automating workflows and keeping things, you know, driving productivity and efficiencies. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering about that. But I was thinking in terms of documents. I mean, I've never read a complete policy because it's too wordy. I have to imagine that reviewing documents has got to be a part of something, not only reviewing, but driving the documentation to get the wording right would be a perfect use for artificial intelligence.
Totally. So there are platforms that you can use that will compare policies. Mm-hmm. Or you can just take two policies, dump them into ChatGPT and say, what are the differences?
Yeah.
The problem is you got to verify it, because we potentially, if we gave someone bad advice that, you know, wasn't really in the policy language, we're on the hook for millions and millions of dollars. So,
I can imagine. in terms of running an insurance company, what kind of liability is associated with that? Because obviously you're giving, maybe not legal advice, but advice that the rest of us are counting on, and it needs to be right, and sometimes it's not right. So talk to me about the risk associated with that.
Yes. So there's insurance for everything. Mm-hmm. We have a professional liability or errors and omissions policy, like I'd say most brokers have, mm-hmm. but like any policy, there's a limit to that. And so I believe we have a $5 million limit of liability, and so we insure a lot of buildings that are more than $5 million. And so adding one of those buildings could, and then it burns down, could, mm-hmm. you know, destroy our business. So, and we are independent insurance agents or brokers. We're not actually the insurance company. And so we have to look at policies from dozens and dozens of carriers and compare them. So it's a lot. I'm very open to technology that can help us to be more efficient.
Okay. So just as we sort of come to a close a little bit, you've taken on this family business, which is a different kind of responsibility. And I have to imagine when you think about your grandfather and your dad and the rest of the family members, including yourself, that have built this, you want to carry on a legacy, and that's an enormous responsibility to be the CEO of this 87-year-old company that's got this family legacy. Talk to us about that legacy and maybe what you envision for continuing to build on that legacy.
Yeah. So I'd say that my purpose is to make this last and beyond me. And part of that is making sure our ESOP culture lasts a long time, and that we grow and are adaptive to the changing market. So we have a BHAG, which not many people in my company like the term BHAG. So we've changed it to the BIS goal, but
okay, BHAG, big hairy audacious goal. Yeah. So you have, I like that you have a big hairy, even though you don't call it that. Okay, so what is that big goal?
So we're 87 now, mm-hmm. 87 years old. When we're 100 years old, we're going to be $50 million in revenue.
Nice.
And we're $12 million now. So that gives me 13 years. Big part of that's going to be organic growth. So we're growing our broker team right now so that we can reach new customers. But then I'm focused on growing through acquisition. And so what agencies are nearby that would complement us and, you know, springboard our growth?
And what would that be? Would that be somebody with, how small of a business would that be? I mean, there's people out there that are doing it out of their house, and then there's other people that maybe have, let's say, 5 or 10 employees.
Yeah. Both are great. We have, so I've done three or four deals and one didn't work out. And it was all because of culture and expectations. Mm-hmm. So we obviously, I do care what the asset is and how valuable it is and making sure we pay appropriately for it. But who's going to be joining the team? What's the customer base like? Are the accounts in verticals that we specialize in? We're big into specializing so that we can really dive deep into supporting our clients in construction and manufacturing. If it's an ag book,
in not like as attractive.
Maybe not, but if they have some good talent, maybe it is. Now okay. We have a new expertise. So I'm just trying to keep an open mind and talk to a lot of folks and learn. And
that's exciting.
But I also have a strategy behind this, and we're trying to be professional in how I build a pipeline and use, you know, our sales tools like Zoom Info to really maximize my connections with these mm-hmm. folks.
Very cool. So is proximity to Sacramento important, or because you're in 10 states?
Yeah, I think we would be open to Nevada, growth in Nevada, the great state. And my sister lives up there, so that'd be okay. Cool. Go up there more. I am a control freak. And so to think about building a book of business somewhere else, it's very portable, you know? And so maybe someday, not now.
Yeah, but it's somebody that tucked right into what you got going right now. Okay. Okay, so what did I not ask you? What else do we want to make sure that we share with this small business entrepreneurial audience?
We talked about the power of employee ownership. Talked about specialization. I'd say... one thing that's unique about our business is that, there's a lot of unique things, but we have a 100% female-led company. So all of the directors are women. If you look at...
That by design or was that by accident?
It just kind of
you didn't exclude us.
That. No, we still interview men, but it's a really interesting and cool vibe to have these 9 women leading the organizations.
Interesting. When you say 9 women, is that your board is all women too?
No. So myself, the CFO, the department heads. Gotcha. So that's the 9 of us.
Well, I'm sure a lot gets done though, because I look at the difference between me and my wife. Like, she gets a lot of stuff done and I like to talk about it and dream about it and get other people to help me do it. So I can imagine a bunch of people who really just crank out the work.
Yeah. Well, we've in terms of like developing our people, we've spent a lot of time going through a leadership cohort and learning about each other and what our strengths are. We just did The Working Genius, which is really cool. You should check it out if you haven't. Hmm. But we've learned that, hey, the personality styles are all over the place. So we have some folks that are worker bees, but I am more of a on the bookends of a project. So I will tell you what I envision, and then I will tell you if we did it. But I don't really want to be here in the middle.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And so we're just trying to play to folks' strengths, and then we're working to pass that down to the organization. So we're just really trying to maximize our effectiveness. We've embraced the traction model or EOS.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that. So it's exciting times at Bender. So in 10 years, so I've been doing the show 10 years. I think you and I talked about that at the beginning of the show. And if I'm still alive, I'll probably be doing the show in 15 years. Nice. You'll be at 50 million. We got to get you back on when you hit the 50 million milestone.
Yes,
and we'll do a little celebration.
Yes.
I love it. Well, I appreciate what you do for the family business people in the region. Obviously, what you're doing for the business community overall. And thanks for coming on the show, Maggie.
Thanks, Mark. That's awesome.
You bet. And to all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship and for the backyard advantage, and of course, all of you out there fighting the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life. Here at Haney Biz, the Mark Haney Show, and the Growth Factory, we're never above you, we're never below you, always by your side.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in this segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.